write yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets as free men now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. Okay, lots of news this past week. And what we're going to talk about today is the bomb, the fuse, and the dud. Oh, okay, what do those three related terms mean here? Well, the bomb is the Eurozone Central Bank putting in a new $1.5 trillion of QE, quantitative easing, money, liquidity injection into the rapidly sagging Eurozone economy, which is now in recession and experiencing deflation for the first time in 5 years again. Okay, really got the folks at the top concerned what's going on with this Eurozone. And they finally convinced their central bank to pump $1.5 trillion, $60 billion a month, into the euro economy. Well, how does it do that? Well, there's several ways to put money into the economy, but QE, quantitative easing, means we're going to print the money, and then the central bank or the governing council of the European Central Bank, which is composed of all the other national central banks, are going to print money and buy bonds. Buy bonds from whom? That's an important question. Who is going to buy what? Are each of those 18 Eurozone central banks going to buy an equal amount of bonds in each of their countries? Or are those countries that are in most stress in the southern periphery or in Eastern Europe, for example, are they going to buy more bonds? What bonds are we talking about? Is it going to be government bonds of each of those countries? Or is it going to be private bonds, bank bonds, corporate bonds? Well, if it's the latter and even the former, that means they're going to print money and they're going to buy the bonds from the holders of the bonds, the bondholders, who are other private banks and financial institutions and super wealthy finance capitalists. They're the folks holding those bonds, including hedge funds and so forth. And not just in Europe, but there are foreign holders of bonds. So presumably, if they spend the money to buy bonds from U.S. hedge funds, well, that money's going to go out of the economy. It's not going to have any effect there. So who's buying what from whom is the question. And I would add, at what price? Well, are we going to... Is France going to buy bonds from American hedge funds? Well, how much are they going to pay when they buy those bonds? Well, you won't hear how much they pay, whether they overpay or what they pay, because you didn't hear it in the U.S. when the U.S. was doing its QE bond buying. The Federal Reserve was printing money and just buying these bonds from rich investors, and no one knows how much they were paying for them. Were they paying above market price? Probably, i.e. a big subsidy for the holders of bonds. Now, this is bondholder heaven here. Yeah, they're going to get really further rich, not that they weren't already. The bondholders love this. So this is the big bomb. Bomb, a B-O-M-B, bomb, a bond bomb, you might say. They're dropping a bond bomb here with QE in the Eurozone. Now, it's not as if the European Central Bank hasn't been pumping money into the bondholders already. Yes, they have. $2 to $3 trillion through other programs called the Long-Term Refinancing Option, LTRO 1 and 2, and other programs. They've been, for the last 5 years, since the so-called recovery, not much recovery in Europe, have been buying, putting money into the economy, injecting liquidity, as we say, into the economy. And what has happened to the Eurozone economy? Nothing. Nothing. There's been no real growth. There's still 11-12% unemployment. GDP is flat and declining. And prices are falling, deflating, after already spending $2 to $3 trillion. So another $1.5 trillion, is that supposed to make a difference? Not really, folks. It's really not about generating growth. It's about helping the stock markets get back on their feet in Europe. In other words, investors. It's all about getting the euro investors more money in their pockets. Yes, that's how it works. The central bank prints money, buys their bonds. They get money for those worthless bonds, which they give back to the central bank because they're buying, you know, they're selling their bonds. Who knows how much they're getting for them? What are they going to do with all that extra $1.5 trillion? Well, they're investors. They're going to invest it. Where are they going to invest it? In the European stock markets, probably, mostly. And there's other markets, too. You know, there's all kind of derivative plays they can make. There's all kinds of other bonds that they can invest in other securities. They can buy other foreign currencies. Yeah, that's what they'll do. They'll speculate in foreign currencies. They'll speculate in other kinds of financial instruments. Because all of this QE stuff, whether it's in Europe now or in Japan recently or the U.S. and the U.K. before, stimulates financial asset markets. Very little gets into the real economy. And they know that. Yes, they tell you that it's all about stimulating the economy, but they know better. They know that that's not what it's all about. They know it's all about helping their buddies, their investor buddies. The bankers take care of themselves. Central bankers take care of the private bankers. Yeah, look, you know, in the U.S., we've had QE. We've had three versions of QE since 2009. The U.S. Central Bank pumped almost $4 trillion into private investors, institutional, hedge funds, so forth, and rich folks who were holding U.S. government bonds and mortgage bonds. Remember, mortgage bonds collapsed. They were collapsed. They were worthless almost in the U.S. after the housing crash. Ah, but the Federal Reserve printed money, went out and bought those mortgage bonds from those wealthy bondholders, and who knows how much they paid them for those bonds. I'm sure it was more than they were worth at a market price. They won't tell us that. The Fed doesn't print and doesn't even allow Congress to see the results of individual purchases. So we don't know who got what. And then our friend Ben Bernanke, the chair of the Federal Reserve until last year, he leaves the Federal Reserve. And what happens? He goes around and he makes hundreds of thousands of dollars, $250,000 to give one speech to this banker conference or that business convention and whatever. You know, that's how they reward their friends. Not while they're there, because it would be too obvious. They wait until they retire, and then they put them on a talking circuit, and they pay them super inflated funds. Or they ghostwrite a book for them and pay them in advance, $1 million in advance for a book that doesn't sell. But the business folks put up the money for the publisher and so forth. You know, these are the little tricks they have, rewarding their friends. And, of course, Ben Bernanke was a big friend of the banks, gave them an awful lot of money with almost $4 trillion of quantitative easing. Of course, that wasn't all the money they got. That was just the printed money that they then bought the bonds with. The U.S. Federal Reserve, but the Federal Reserve also engineered interest rates of less than 1% that they could borrow from, and they did. But that was over $10 trillion of money that just was lent at 0.25% or thereabouts from the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, right, to these other banks, including shadow banks, you know, like hedge funds, private equity firms, and so forth, you know, or through the commercial banks to them. So 10 trillion plus an almost 4 trillion, 14 trillion minimum that the central bank of the United States pumped into the investor class in the U.S., the new finance capital elite, as I call them, their institutions, you know, the equity funds, hedge funds, finance companies, et cetera. Well, now, that was so successful for those folks that the Bank of Japan did this in 2013. You know, they had been dribbling out money at very low interest rate, virtually zero, to their friends since the 1990s, and that wasn't enough. And Japan has been in and out of recession repeatedly since 2009. They've had four recessions. They're in the middle of their fourth right now. So what happened after the end of the third recession? Oh, we need even more money. So the Bank of Japan engaged in its own QE policy. And that QE policy was, when it was announced, was almost $700 billion a year. Now, $700 billion a year on a GDP, Japan GDP, of about $5 to $6 trillion is a big chunk as a percent of GDP. Oh, that was a big injection, as big or bigger, given the size of the Japanese economy, well, actually bigger than the U.S. Federal Reserve's injection of free money and QE. Okay, so Bank of Japan, equivalent of $1.7 trillion injected over the last 2 years, U.S. $4 trillion in QE, Bank of Japan $1.7 trillion in QE, Bank of England $600 billion of QE. $600 billion, you know, in British pounds terms, it was £375 billion. In Japan's yen terms, it was 200 trillion yen. You translate that into dollars, you know, it's like 1.5 to 2 trillion in Japan, 600 billion in Bank of England, UK, 3.7 trillion U.S. in U.S. dollars. Wow. And then the ECB, European Central Bank, was dribbling free money out there for years, a couple trillion, and now another 1.5 trillion. As they announced yesterday, $60 billion a month, they're going to print money and buy in Europe. That's about $68, $69 billion a month, and it's over $800 billion a year. They're going to go for 2 years, they said. And it's actually, it's open-ended, but all the talk beneath the surface is at least 21 to 24 months. So, you know, you're talking another $1.5 trillion equivalent, at least, in Europe. So add it up, okay? $4 trillion almost U.S., half a trillion U.K., $1.5 to $2 trillion in Japan, another $1.5 trillion. You're looking at $7 to $9 trillion of printed money that the central banks have printed and gone out and bought these bonds, and who knows what price, from wealthy investors. That's who they're, you know, banks, bankers, and their other financial institutions, hedge funds, equity funds, whatever, and individual big bondholders, individual bondholders as well. $9 trillion pumped into the economy. And what did we get for this mountain of cash? You got a molehill of recovery. Really, everywhere. Well, Japan's in and out. Now it's in recession again, even though $1.7 trillion. In recession again. The Eurozone, in recession. England, well, they had a little recovery for a while. That's because they reignited their housing market and encouraged foreign investors to come and buy into their London and South England housing markets, and that gave an injection. Short-term injection, it produced a bubble in the housing market, and of course now that's fading as well, and the growth is fading there in the UK as well. And in the US, we've been in a stop-go, stop-go kind of a thing. Every time the stock market slowed down, oh, another QE, and the stock market went right up again. And then when the stock market slowed down, another QE, and right up. We did that three times. Okay, so we haven't done a QE4. And there's all this talk about, oh, the U.S. economy has taken off here with this 5% third quarter 2014 growth. No, no, will you watch? It's going to come back down to 1.5% to 2% growth, which is the long-term growth the U.S. economy is stuck at. We get these little bubbles up and down because of special factors. Before elections, typically we get the third quarter boost before elections, and business hoping that there's going to be a big Christmas rush, so they increase their inventories third quarter, and for 3 years, three times in a row, what's happened is the consumer spending did not come through, and then come January, you get a big contraction of inventories, and the government spending before the election it dissipates as well, and at the beginning of the next year, you get a big reversal in the GDP growth rate. Well, that's going to happen again for the fourth time. In other words, QE is having no real effect on the real economy anywhere, anywhere. $9 trillion, and you don't get any real growth. But what you do get with all of that free money is bubbles, financial asset bubbles, because the money's going to investors, and investors aren't investing in real things, not investing in real goods and services. They're investing in quick fix, quick capital gains, financial asset securities. And that causes the bubbles. Well, we got a bubble in the U.S. stock market, no doubt. And we have a bubble in the U.S. junk bond market, no doubt. And a bunch of other markets around the world. There's bubbles everywhere. But, you know, the bubbles can't go on forever. We have this phenomenon. If you watch the U.S. stock market, you know, what's been happening? Well, you know, it's at 17,000, the Dow, and 18,000. And whenever there's a crisis in the world, the stock market starts rapidly contracting, you know, like this oil glut situation here. And then the Swiss National Bank issue we'll talk about. It drops about 1,000, but then it comes right back again. That's because there's so much money and wealthy folks on the sidelines, and they are so desperate for yield, as they say, returns, that as soon as one of these financial bubbles, market somewhere sags, they throw their money back in. There are trillions and trillions and tens of trillions of dollars sitting on the sideline that could be used to really stimulate the U.S. and global economy to produce things and jobs and income for everybody, but it's all bottled up in the wallets of the rich, and they don't want to invest in longer term in things that create jobs because they make even more profits investing short term in financial liquidity and financial asset markets. That's the big change in 21st century global capitalism. Finance capital is ruling the roost, and finance capital likes to invest in securities. They don't like to invest in high-risk, long-term, expected return things. I'm not saying that there isn't that kind of investment going on. Yes, there is, but relative to financial speculation, it's the lesser investment trend going on. And most of it was going on, real investment was going on anyway in China, emerging markets, and now that's coming to an end. So it's all financial speculation, folks. And QE feeds this beast, pumps more and more money into them. In fact, they become addicted to QE. They become addicted, they meaning finance capitalists, they become addicted to the free money. And it's going to be very difficult to wean them off of it. Oh, they talk about raising interest rates, which is a method for weaning them off of the free money. They're going to have a big surprise once they start raising interest rates. Just as zero interest rates had virtually no effect on the real global economy in terms of stimulating real growth, rising interest rates is going to have an excessive effect. Oh, it sounds contradictory, doesn't it? No, not really, because the same conditions that create no real impact in the real economy with lower interest rates are the same conditions which will exacerbate the contraction when rates start to rise. Now, I talk about this in my new forthcoming book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, The Dead Cat Bounce Recovery of 2011-13. That comes out earlier this spring, and we'll talk about that more in future shows. But for now, it talks about the forces, the conditions underlying the global economy and the U.S. economy that prevent a real sustained economic recovery, that lead us to more financial instability, which is growing. Systemic fragility is what I call it. Fragility in consumption, household consumption, fragility in business investment, and fragility in government accounts. Systemic fragility, put them all together. And that's the condition in the global economy right now. It makes it very fragile to a new crisis here. Okay, let's get back to the ECB, though, and talk more about not just the numbers with regard to QE, but what is QE really about? Well, on the surface, it's about pumping money, liquidity, as they call it, into the hands of investors, institutional, individual, right? And it's a direct, immediate, emergency kind of way of injecting liquidity. The old ways of injecting liquidity through central bank of bond buying and so forth are not sufficient to satisfy their finance capital money addicted friends. So now they do it directly, immediately, directly. And that's what QE is all about. You print the money. You don't have to go through the governments and raise bonds. You just print the money and go buy the bonds out there. Now, what QE does is emphasize short-term bailout of banks. It bails out banks, financial institutions, balance sheets, which during the crisis collapse, in other words, big losses. So QE is really initially and fundamentally about bailing out the banks, you know, both shadow banks and commercial regulated banks, provide huge amounts of liquidity in order to prevent insolvency and bankruptcy in the banks. That's what it's initially about. But then it sort of morphed into saying, well, you know, this is not only a way to bail out the banks, it's a way of generating long-term economic growth and recovery. That's what soon became the mantra after the first injections of QE and the banks were boarded up, bailed out. Right? The problem is, though, when you put that money into the banks, it doesn't necessarily lead to lending by the banks to real businesses that would stimulate real economic growth. I mean, the second assumption that more liquidity leads to a growth in GDP, gross domestic product growth, is absolutely false. That relationship between the central bank and the banks and economic growth is totally broken down. You know, in the past, the central bank would pump money, buy and sell bonds and pump money into the private banking system. The banks would then lend it to real businesses that would hire people and you'd have growth. Well, that's not what's happening. What's happening is it's given to the banks and the banks hoard the money, or shadow banks or individual investors. They hoard the money. They sit on it. Banks are sitting on record amount of reserves right now, trillions of dollars that they're not lending. And that doesn't count what they have lent to speculators or offshore. You see, they're sitting on huge amounts, but even equal amounts were lent, but they were lent offshore to emerging markets in China, right? And a huge share of what was pumped into them were lent to shadow banks and others to speculate in financial asset markets, market stocks and bonds and the $5 trillion a day foreign exchange market, etc. So you either hoard it, you send it offshore, or you speculate in financial markets with it. That's what the banks and shadow banks have done with this trillions and trillions of dollars of money that was put on the balance sheets of the banks to bail them out, far more than they needed for bailout, because it's sitting on a huge hoard, and they've already lent it out to speculation and to offshore markets. Now, the offshore markets' growth is coming to an end. So, you know, they're not even lending out to the emerging markets that much anymore, and China doesn't need that much because it's slowing down, and the demand for funds is not as great. So there's more hoarding going on. So they're so flush with cash, right? But it's not getting from the banks to the businesses and sources, governments, local governments, that would invest it to benefit everyone else. So this whole idea, this morphing of the bailout, the QE, to assume it would mean real economic growth is totally false. You know, if you go back and you read the statements of the Federal Reserve Bank, initially they said, QE will stimulate economic growth. Well, it didn't. And then they changed the tune and said, QE is going to lower the unemployment rate. Okay, so we hired a bunch of part-timers and so forth, and people dropped out of the labor force, and the unemployment rate came down. And now they say, it's really about getting the price level up to 2%, because when you have a slowing economy, one of the best indicators is the prices begin to decline and you get deflation, and that's popping up everywhere. And even in the U.S., we are slowing, our price level is slowing down dramatically. You know, prices rose, 0.4% here in December. And for last year, the CPI, Consumer Price Index, rose less than 1%. Well, that's Europe a year ago, as it slid towards deflation. And, of course, Europe now is in deflation. Japan, even though they pumped trillions of dollars, they got a little boost in their price level, but now it's down to 1%. So everywhere, despite QE, the price level continues over the long term to slide, to slow. And there's this slow slouching towards deflation everywhere in the global economy, because the real economy globally is slowing down as well. Okay. Now, QE, when you pump money into the economy, it drives down interest rates long term. And that's what's happening as well. Interest rates are coming down everywhere. In Europe, they're negative. Yeah, you want to put your money in the bank in Europe? They charge you. You got to pay the bank to put your money in the bank in Europe in some case. Negative interest rates all over Europe. And even, their government bonds. And even in Germany, government bonds, what kind of interest do you get on a 10-year bond? Less than 0.5% or 1%. Yeah, virtually nothing. You know, 2-year bonds in the U.S., the same thing. And we see that 10-year bonds and 30-year bonds in the U.S., our interest rates are slowly, long-term, sliding, following Europe and following Japan, which is absolutely zero in Japan. Like 0.5% or 1/100% or something is what you get for putting your money in Japanese bonds. Okay, so interest rates everywhere, because you're pumping so much money into the economy, have come down to virtually nothing. Well, when money is so cheap for folks who could borrow from the Fed, i.e. bankers and shadow bankers in turn, what are they going to do? They're going to borrow all that money and then go speculate with it. And corporations, non-banking corporations, what are they going to do? Oh, they're going to issue corporate bonds because the interest rates are so low to pay on corporate bonds. Let's borrow money from these other financial institutions in the rich who are getting the free money from the banks. They're going to buy our corporate bonds. And the corporate bonds, we're going to use that money to, like Apple, what are we going to do? $50 billion in corporate bond issuance here in the last year or so. But what did they do with it? Oh, they hoard the cash. They buy back their stock from their shareholders, a nice big windfall, capital gains windfall for their shareholders. They buy back their stock. And, of course, buying it back in large numbers drives the price up. It's a big capital gains for the big shareholders of stocks. Or they give it back in huge dividends. In the U.S. alone, in the last 3 years, non-financial corporations like Apple and so forth have given back trillions of dollars to their shareholders. Trillions. Literally trillions in the last 5 years. Well, no wonder we got such income inequality going on. The rich are raking it in hand over fist as their companies buy back their stock and increase their dividends. And, of course, we lower the tax rate so they don't have to pay capital gains on dividends. They get to keep all this money. But the money is coming from the corporations that are buying back their stock, paying the dividends. And they're borrowing the money from the banks and the shadow banks to pay the dividends and so forth because it's so cheap to borrow, issue bonds, right? And the Federal Reserve and central banks are printing the money and giving it, essentially giving it, to the banks and shadow bankers who then are borrowed from, float the bonds for the non-financial corporations, the Apples and IBMs and so forth, who then give it to their shareholders in buybacks and dividends. You see how the money flows, and the money flow starts with the central banks. And that's why we got this huge inequality going on. The rich are getting richer hand over fist, $9 trillion in QE. I'm not even counting other ways of zero interest rates, which play the same role. It's QE and monetary policy on steroids, money injection to the rich on steroids, you know, over and above and in addition to the normal zero interest rates. And this is the game that's going on. And it's accelerated. It's been going on since Reagan, and it's accelerating now under Obama and since the crash. And more money's going. That's why 95% of all the income gains since 2009, the so-called recovery, has gone to the wealthiest 1%. Now, that 1% are all investors and bondholders. Those folks don't work for a living. Oh, they may be CEOs and so forth as well, you know, but they're not wage and salary earners. You know, they're investors. They're bonds and stocks and foreign exchange and derivatives investors. That's what they do. That's why they're so rich. At the same time, income inequality is getting worse for a second reason, and that is wages and wage incomes are stagnant and falling. In the U.S., since 2009, median family income has declined 1% to 2% every year. And it was declining even before that, by the way. So wages are going down. Incomes are going up for the wealthy class. And you get a double whammy effect on income inequality. Okay. Now, let's talk more about QE and liquidity, right? Generates zero interest rates. Leads to speculation. Leads to more debt, i.e. borrowing. You know, investors, when they invest in these markets, they don't like to use all their own money, even though it's they're walking away with barrels of it. They borrow, and that's called leverage. You know, they borrow from the banks and the hedge funds and the equity firms and so on and so forth, right? They borrow $9 and use one of their own. Actually, they borrow 95 cents and use 5 cents of their own or 2 cents of their own. They borrow that much in order to finance their payouts, dividends, and buybacks, and mergers and acquisitions, and so forth. Oh, that just pumps up these shadow banks and these shadow liquidity markets even more. They become even more dominant globally. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve and the central banks try to regulate the commercial banks, the regulated banks, you know, the J.P. Morgans and so on and so forth, right? They tell them, look, from the last financial crash, you guys were tied too closely to the shadow banks. And when they went under, they pulled you under, too. And but, you know, you, J.P. Morgan, you folks and Wells, you hold regular folks' deposits, and that's risky. We don't want you to do that. So you got to hold more capital. You got to have more cash on hand, they're telling the commercial banks. Right? You have to engage in less risky investments like these shadow banks. You know, we get the Volcker Rule. We get Basel 1 and 2. In other words, you got to keep so much real money on hand in case there's a crisis, pretty much. So that leads the banks to hoard even more and not lend more. and it increases the role of the shadow banks even more. Look, you know, you can regulate these commercial banks, but if you don't regulate the shadow banks, you're not regulating anything, because the money's just going to flow through the commercial banks to the shadow banks. They're going to do their same risky stuff, which they are doing. And meanwhile, the commercial banks said, hey, you know, that's not fair to us. We can't compete with these guys. We got to hold more capital, and we can't engage in risky derivatives trading. You know, you're putting us, commercial banks, at a disadvantage, and therefore you have to roll back these regulations from Dodd-Frank and so forth. And that's what they're doing right now. And, of course, Congress is accommodating them again, right? So we're creating the preconditions for the next crisis, the next financial crisis, because the money and the debt is growing. And the private side, I'm not talking about government debt, I'm talking about private debt, private side. A recent report by the Bank of International Settlements in Geneva very clearly pointed out that there's been a huge increase in debt borrowing by the private side. Not households, private businesses. In other words, rates are so low because of all this pumping of liquidity, businesses and investors are borrowing more and more and more, creating more and more debt, which is the precursor, precondition for another crash. Right? Now, there's other negatives to QE as well that are worth talking about. You know, one, first of all, it hasn't produced any price stability. In other words, this whole thing of getting prices up to 2%, nope. They're all falling everywhere. It hasn't generated any real GDP growth. It hasn't generated any real income growth for the overwhelming majority of folks. It's generated a lot of income growth for the rich and financial speculators, right? The linkage between the central banks and the real economy has broken down as a result of this. The private banks don't funnel the money given by the Fed into the real economy as much anymore. They funnel it into speculators, right? It doesn't lead to lending that produces real investment and real growth. What it does do is lead to more financial asset bubbles. And it lowers the real disposable income and consumption for large sectors of the economy. In other words, when rates are so low, yeah, it's great for businesses and investors to borrow at free money. But what happens to average folks who rely on, some sort of interest income, like retirees, 50 million retirees? Well, there's, you don't get any interest income on CDs or anything like that anymore. So average folks who aren't investors and speculators, they have less income as a result. So QE actually drives down income for normal savers, and it shifts that income to the very wealthy. Okay. Now, QE also sets off competitive devaluations and currency wars. We're seeing that very clearly right now. Currency wars are now going to erupt as never before. The euro, of course, has been devalued. You pump all that money into the economy, it drives the value of your currency down, and that's what's happened in Europe. You know, the euro was trading at $1.20 and change to the U.S. dollar. Now it's down to about $1.13 and change. So it's already dropped almost 10% in just a few days here. And as I predicted 2 years ago, the euro was going to fall at least parity with the dollar. One euro, $1. So it's a 20% devaluation of the euro. Now, governments say in Europe, one of their objectives is, let's devalue the currency so that our exports, our euro exports, will be more competitive, and we can steal some of the exports as well, undercut price, and steal exports from other competitors, from China, from emerging markets, from the USA, and we'll grow our economy by devaluing our currency. So this is kind of a strategy for generating economic real growth through exports. The problem is everybody can do that. Any country can do that. And that's what Japan just did. drove down its yen with its QE to get an advantage against Europe. And that's probably one of the reasons why Europe's slowing down. And that's why with Japan lowering its currency, China reversed its policy and started lowering its currency's value, the yuan, as well. So we have this competitive devaluation going on. Competition by devaluation. You know, this is what happened during the Great Depression of the 30s, except then things were tied sort of to a gold standard, so a country had to issue a declaration that its currency would not would be lowered with regard to the price of gold or something like that, right? Those kind of devaluations to try in desperation to get their economy going at the expense of other economies. You see, that's what the competitive devaluations are all about. Let's get our economy going at the expense of the others. Beggar your neighbor growth. Well, we got currency wars going on right now. And the big currency war, of course, is the tit-for-tat, the Eurozone QE devaluation in response to the Japanese QE devaluation of about a year ago. Now watch Japan to do another QE here at some point in response to the Euro QE. And thus all the advantage of the Euro devaluation will disappear, right? Because it'll be offset by a Japanese devaluation or a Chinese devaluation or whatever, UK devaluation, the pound. We're in the area of currency wars once again, and more instability in the global economy. Now, you may have heard a few days ago, before the European Central Bank announced its QE policy, that earlier in the week, that the Swiss National Bank, Switzerland, which isn't part of the Eurozone, it's independent, the Swiss franc, right? What they did was essentially, in anticipation of QE coming, decided that they were not going to peg the Swiss franc to the euro anymore, and they were going to let the value of the Swiss franc rise in relationship to the euro. And that's exactly what it did, by 20% overnight. Well, actually 40%, then it settled back down to 20%. And, well, why did they do that? Why did the Swiss National Bank do that? Well, to protect the value of the investments of its bondholders. Yes. Look, if you were holding Swiss francs when they did that decision last week, the value of your holdings would have gone up 20% overnight. You would have made a 20% profit just by holding investments in Swiss banks, right? Companies that, and we all know the global rich in North America and Europe put a lot of their money in Swiss banks, right? And they shelter it there. So all those folks, they got a nice 20% profit overnight for doing nothing. Overnight. Protect the bondholders. Now that means the Swiss businesses, the value of the currency is going to be kind of high. Higher now, and that means that they're not going to be as competitive in terms of exports. So Swiss businesses like Nestle and some of the others are going to hurt, right? But the big bondholders, the finance capitalists, are making a killing in Switzerland, and that means global finance capitalists, because all the super rich and put money in Swiss banks that hide it for them, right? It's the Swiss bank, Switzerland, is a big laundering operation for the rich, always has been. Okay, so QE is going to is setting off currency wars, competitive devaluations. Now, competitive devaluations are an indication that the capitalists are getting more desperate, that they got to resort to more aggressive ways of competing with each other. And the state, the capitalist state, is going to help them more than ever. In this more intensifying competition between them. Now, another problem is QE freezes the interbank lending market, which is very important, banks lending to each other. But if they can go to the government and get free money now and get all the other money through QE, well, why do they have to lend with each other? Well, they're damaging the global financial system, central banks are, by atrophying the whole interbank lending market. Who knows if it'll be able to come back as they become more dependent on free QE, addicted to it at the central banks. That's what's changing here in the 21st century. Now, the problem is, as I said, QE doesn't produce real results, and that leads them to say, oh, well, we didn't do enough, let's double down. So they become even more addicted to free money and central bank liquidity injections, because the money ends up in financial speculation and in financial asset inflation, does not get to the real economy. You end up with real goods deflation. You know, all this talk about pumping QE is going to bring the real goods and services, you know, things we buy, back up to 2% is nonsense, because the money does not flow there. The money flows in the other direction. It flows to financial assets and bankers and wealthy investors. And because it's flowing there instead of in normal directions for real investment, you get deflation. At the same time, because the money is going to the top and it's not really generating real recovery, the lack of real recovery means that governments get deficits and more debt. The slow, uneven recovery after 5 years now means that governments, you know, to different degrees at different times, have deficits. Well, then they say, the same folks that say we need more QE, i.e. the bankers and their friends, say, oh, we need austerity on the fiscal side, because we're not getting real growth, and we know we're not getting real growth, and we got to hold the line on the government budgets, because all the money going to financial investment means that we're not going to have enough money generating taxes and so forth, so there's going to be stress on government deficits and debt. Therefore, we got to cut. We got to have austerity. Austerity meaning government's got to cut its spending, or it gives tax cuts to the rich to stimulate the falsely claims that it's going to stimulate the tax increases, which it doesn't, but the tax cuts exacerbate the deficit problem at the same time. So we got to have government spending cuts, or government has to raise money by selling off assets. You know, that's going on a lot. Places like Greece and in Europe sell off government assets to raise money. And or you lay off government employees, or you eliminate pensions and benefits for government employees, and or you cut the government Social Security pension funds and all that stuff. You know, that's to hold the line on the deficit that's not going to really be resolved while you pump all this money into the financial system and the rich, and hope that after a while, the markets will, even though you're pumping it into the rich, the markets will slowly recover for the rest of the economy. You see, that's what it's all about. It's about supply side. It's about, let's increase the supply of money to the rich, and then the, you know, recover them, right? Bail them out, and the rest of the economy, the capitalist market system, will heal itself. They've always believed that, back to the 19th century, that the market will correct itself. One of the biggest myths. But one that's very convenient for them, allows them to put money at the very top, and hope that the economy slowly over time, and who cares how long it takes for the rest of us if the, you know, if they're doing fine, if corporate profits are at record record levels, and trillions of dollars in dividends and stock buybacks are occurring, and everybody on the investor side sitting on these huge hoards of cash, you know, they're all recovered. They were recovered quickly. You know, there's no need to put money into the rest, because the market will slowly trickle down, and the rest will slowly, and yeah, if it takes 5 to 10 years, so what? That's their philosophy. That's what they really believe, and that's why they're bailing out the top first. But the top has got addicted to it all. They're addicted, and they want more and more and more. They want to keep doing this because it's such a golden goose, right? And that's where we are today. You know, the goose is getting fatter and fatter, and the money is being force-fed down his throat, and they love it. They love it. They think that's the new normal, and that's the way things should continue. And, you know, the rest will come along in due course. It's the supply side. It's all about making the rich richer in the hope that they will trickle down some of it and spend it on the rest of us. So what you got to do is give them more money, you know. Even on the non-financial side, what is it all about? It's about tax cuts, i.e. reduce, put more money in the hands of businesses with tax cuts, low interest rates, put more money in the hands of businesses, and lower wages, put more money in the hands of businesses. And the assumption in their theory is that having more money, they will, businesses will then now invest, and that will create jobs and create recovery. Well, that was the nonsense they were talking about in the depths of the Great Depression back in 1930. And John Maynard Keynes kind of punctured that balloon and said, no, no, more money in the hands of businesses isn't going to necessarily result in investment and recovery and the growth of income. And in fact, what it's going to do is depress income for the rest so there's not as much consumption, and you're going to go down lower. And that can go on for, you know, unlimited number of years of stagnation. Well, we're still fighting those ideological battles in economics, unfortunately, and it's no different today than it was way back then. The whole idea of supply side is lower business wage costs, lower business taxes, lower business interest rates, and they will then turn around and invest that, and that will stimulate the recovery. Well, it just doesn't happen empirically. Just look at the empirical record. Putting more money in their hands does what through these means? Tax cuts, low interest, wage cuts. What does it do? They hoard it, they send it offshore, or they put it into financial speculation. And that's the empirical record of the last 5-6 years. That's where all the money is going. And that's why we're not getting any recovery. It's that simple. QE is really an ideological excuse. You know, they say it's raising inflation rates. They say it would stimulate GDP. They say it will lower unemployment and so forth. Now, all it does is put more money in the hands of speculators. Exactly. And that's why you see stock markets at record, right? And the Europeans want to get their stock market up to the U.S. one. So we're going to do a QE2, right? And the Japanese, the same thing. Same policies everywhere in advanced economies, U.S., U.K., Europe, Japan, advanced capitalist economies, same thing. Primary policy is QE and monetary injections, right? And hold the line on fiscal policy, because it's going to take a long time to generate growth and we won't want the deficit debt to rise in the meantime. You say austerity is the flip side, the necessary flip side in their view of money injection and QE and free money. They both go hand in hand. And they don't care about, well, let's stimulate middle class and working class. Let's give them some income so that they can spend, and the spending on their products will mean, okay, then we got to invest. And if we don't start from the demand side, the income side, because that means bailing out the people first. No, no, you bail us out first, and even if it takes longer this way, then so be it. You bail out the investors first. And if they're going slow and so forth, then that's just the way it's got to be. The market will take care of the rest of you eventually. In the long run, the market recovered. In the long run, we're dead too, you know? So this QE stuff going on in Europe is just a continuation of a long trend here for at least the last 5-6 years, relying on printing of money as well as pumping money through bond purchases into the hands of banks, shadow banks, and investors in the hopes that what we're going to have is a recovery, which doesn't occur. We get inflation and recovery in financial asset markets, but not in the real side. And it sets off these currency wars through competitive devaluations that are now going to intensify. They're already intensifying. It creates asset price bubbles that go bust and cause financial crises periodically here, and that's coming as well. It It changes the structure of the global banking market, you know, destroys the interbank lending market. It leads to addiction to free money, an expectation of more and more free money. It leads to declines in real disposable income for huge sections of the rest of the economy. And that's the legacy of this stuff, you know? Interestingly, even some on the business side are beginning to recognize the futility of this whole approach, right? Interesting editorial in the Wall Street Journal yesterday by David Malpass, "The World's Monetary Dead End," right? Quote, "Buying low-yield bonds is a dead end for growth." Quote, "QE harms the economy. Growth, inflation, and median incomes keep going down." Quote, "Sorry track record of helicopter money. Central bank liabilities have grown by $7 trillion since 2008. Yet many parts of the world are in or near recession, including Japan, Latin America, East Europe, and most of the Eurozone." That's coming from a capitalist. Even the capitalists are getting worried. So what do they say, though? What's the answer? Well, the answer is, if you listen to Mario Draghi, the head of the ECB here, right? Okay, we're going to pump this money in, but we need structural reform. Oh, code word, structural reform. What is that? That's, let's attack wages. We've been holding wages down by creating part-time temp jobs and no minimum wage growth and so on and so forth, all the things going on now. Now we got to attack the folks who have, many folks that still have full-time jobs. That's what structural reform means. It means labor market reform, and that means attack wages. It's part of the same thing. Whether you hold the cost down for business and pump up their balance sheets by low interest rates or by tax cuts, you know, you can do it by lowering wages. And that's what structural reform is all about. Big talk in Europe. We need structural reform going on. Japan, India, everybody's talking about structural reform. What it means is, we got to squeeze more from wages now. It's all supply side. Whether you talk about it from a monetary supply side or a tax supply side or a wage cut supply side, it's all about attacking folks. Look, we're in a period globally here where the pie is shrinking, or it's not growing as fast and soon will be shrinking. That means the capitalists in different sectors of the global economy are beginning to attack each other, go after each other, compete even harder with each other. Competitive devaluations, currency war is only one form of that. But it also means that they're going to try to protect their income and their growth of income at the expense of other classes in society, including especially the working class and the middle classes. They're going to squeeze them as they try to squeeze each other. That's a sign of growing instability and contradiction in the global economy today. That's what this signifies, and it's a kind of important threshold, what's going on in Europe, because it now signals that all the advanced economies, have engaged in this monetary QE policy, and the results are very clear what it produces, and they've committed to it anyway. But now they're beginning to realize, well, gee, you know, some of them, that it doesn't really work in terms of generating the real economy. So now they're saying the next phase, now that we've fattened the cats at the top to the point that they're bursting with bucks, the next phase is, in addition to the free money here, we're going to have to start taking some of it back from the working classes in this country and elsewhere around the world. You know, structural reform is already being introduced, labor market reform in Spain, in Italy. France is talking about it, right? And now Draghi, the ECB chairman, says, if I'm putting all this money in, you guys better do some structural reform, too. So that's what's coming, folks. Structural reform, more attacks on wages, and that's the bomb. Well, what's the fuse? I don't have time to talk about the fuse, except to say that the fuse to all this is the Greek elections, where we may have a left-wing government that says no more payments to the bondholders here, restructured his debt. We don't want to go along with it. And that may set off a whole movement for alternative parties, both left and right, in Europe, that will challenge this whole strategy of money, QE, and austerity. this may be the beginning of the pushback here. We'll see. The election comes up on Sunday, whether Syriza, the left-wing government, a party, in Greece, actually takes control. And what's going to be their policy? And what's going to be the response of the capitalist and bondholders to that? Right? That could ignite some hope and some movement. So that's the fuse. And what's the dud? Well, the dud is Obama's State of the Union speech, saying everything, saying nothing. Read my article written before the speech, which is called Republicans Change Rules, Democrats Change Stripes. So that dead on arrival, a dud, as the two wings of the one capitalist class in this country began working in earnest on more corporate tax cuts, more free trade, more money for wars in the Middle East, and more cybersecurity, spying on the rest of us. That's what they're really in agreement on, and behind the scenes, that's really what they're going to do. Okay, we'll talk more about Syriza and Greece next week, as well as watch these policies unfold in the U.S., and in the meantime, understand what QE is about ideologically and in the bigger picture. That's what QE is about. And austerity is its mirror image. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We'll see you next week. We will be talking about Greece. Okay, after the elections. Is the fuse lit? This is Alternative Visions.
Sid Hart and Sid Wilkes and the robber barons, straight to hell, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.